when 9/11 comes along, when the failures of intelligence in the lead up to the Iraqi war come along, it wasn't clear to me as I looked out on what had been written, even in all of the congressional reports, that they were highlighting that this is an incredibly difficult business.
Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. I'm George Gillum, chair of the program. Our speaker today is Robert Kennedy, who has written a book that I really like called Of Knowledge and Power, The Complexities of National Intelligence. Now, for reasons that we need not go into, the book is not being offered for sale here tonight. It's not because it's classified, but because of some issues with the bookstore. But it's a terrific book, and we have put copies of the information about the book on everybody's seat, so you can go to Amazon or wherever and get it. Robert Kennedy is a professor at the Sam Nunn School of International Affairs at Georgia Tech. He received his undergraduate education at the Air Force Academy and his master's and doctorate at Georgetown in the Political Science Department. Robert Kennedy has served as director of the joint German-American George C. Marshall European Center for Security Studies in Germany. In his nearly 35 years of government service, he served as civilian deputy commandant of the NATO Defense College in Rome, very tough duty, and he served as the Dwight D. Eisenhower Professor of National Security Studies at the U.S. Army War College and as the Foreign Affairs Officer at the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, in addition to other postings. This book is as good a primer on the organization and intelligence of the organization and functioning of the intelligence community as anything I have read, although Dr. Kennedy has actually never been part of the intelligence community. He has a great story to tell. Please welcome Dr. Robert Kennedy.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Thank you for that very kind introduction. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I also ought to extend my thanks to Shirley Burke for all the administrative arrangements that she made. And thank you all for being here this evening and give me an opportunity to talk a little bit about this book. And the reason I don't even recommend you buy it, they're charging too much for it. But but at any rate, it was fun for me to do it. And let me tell you before we begin a little bit about how I got involved in this. First of all, it goes back to the fact that, one, I had never been a part of the intelligence community, but having worked for nearly 35 years with the United States government, usually dealing with issues associated with intelligence, I became quite familiar with the problems of intelligence. In my early career, I was an Air Force officer. I knew the importance of intelligence in terms of knowing when we flew our aircraft, what capabilities we were going to go against, what kind of targets that we were hitting the right targets, and what kind of targets they were, and how hard they might be, and what we needed to deliver. Later, when I knew what that might mean if we didn't know that information in terms of my own safety, the safety of others, as we were flying into potential targets. Later, when I left the Air Force, I went to work for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and had the opportunity there to learn how important it is to ask the kind of, you know, the right question. One day, I happened to be in the Military Affairs Division. I had responsibility for the strategic arm limitation talks, one that we were undertaking at that time, mutual balance force reductions in Europe, and the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, all three portfolios. I had a part of that as part of the Military Affairs Division. But one day, the director, then director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, Freddie Clay, called me in and said, well, I'd like to know how many aircraft, I have to brief Congress tomorrow, how many aircraft the Soviet Union has in Europe that are nuclear capable. Well, that was an interesting question. So I went back to my office, started thinking about that, started calling around to the varying agencies. What kind of information do you have? Can I come over and take a look at what you've got? And all of a sudden, the questions started coming like, well, what do you mean by nuclear capable aircraft? Do you mean an aircraft that is currently in Eastern Europe, manned by a Soviet pilot, has all the wiring in it capable, and they train to deliver a nuclear weapon? Is that what you mean by that? Or do you mean an aircraft that has all the wiring, but the crew isn't trained, but they could be trained to deliver a nuclear weapon? Or do you mean one that's in the Western military districts? All of a sudden, it became quite clear that how you ask the question is very important. What do you really want to know, Mr. Clay? What is it that that Congress might want to know? At any rate, shortly after that, I went up to the Army War College, and I had the responsibility of looking at strategic issues between the United States and the Soviet Union, as well as issues that we had with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact in Europe. And one of the issues that came up was, what is the deterrent effect of the neutron bomb, what we call the reduced blast enhanced radiation weaponry, which at the time the president had decided that we would not deploy to Europe. And some of our military people were saying that the Soviet Union was much more deterred if we had this neutron bomb in Europe. And one of the things I learned about that is not only do you know that you have to ask the right question, but you have to ask the question. And nobody, when we went to the intelligence community, had ever been tasked to ask what the Soviet Union's leaders thought about the neutron bomb. So there we were, already briefing Congress on why we needed this weapon in Europe, but we'd never asked the question to our intelligence community to find out what Ustinov, the then Minister of Defense, might have said to Brezhnev, the then Secretary General, or one of the generals had said to another general in European command. So I learned that aspect. Also learned how worst-case planning can get in your way. At the same time, I was looking at Soviet strategic systems, trying to ascertain how vulnerable we were. We were in the midst of regenerating the National Intelligence Estimate in 1970, which was presented in 1976. And some of you here, I sense, are old enough to remember that we organized a Team B. And Team B not only had two factors going for them. They were frequently a group of people that, in many cases, were doing worst-case planning, and also were particularly predisposed to a particular outcome in that. And so they were in contradistinction to Team A, which had been from professionals within the intelligence community to ascertain just how capable Soviet strategic forces were. So when 9/11 comes along, when the failures of intelligence in the lead up to the Iraqi war come along, I began to think that it really is time to understand just how complex the intelligence process is. And it wasn't clear to me as I looked out on what had been written, even in all of the congressional reports, that they were highlighting that this is an incredibly difficult business. It is not something that we always have perfect information on. It is not something that we all agree on, even when we have good information on. It is fraught with a host of problems. And so that's why I decided to do the book. The book examines some 40 or so impediments that we confront as we attempt to gather, analyze, disseminate, and in fact use intelligence. I won't go into all of them. Some of them are things like tendency to focus on the near term as opposed to the more distant area. credibility of the sources that you're getting your information from, the tensions we have within a bureaucracy that sometimes preclude us from passing information from one department to another department, the role of deception, effective use of deception. All of you know how well the United States used deception before the Normandy invasion. Very successful. Ill-defined priorities. Somehow the president always and his senior advisors always think that the intelligence community knows exactly what they should be collecting. After all, presidents made all these statements, senior advisors have made all these statements. You must know what we want. But it's not always clear to those who are gathering information, and it falls on top of information they've already specifically been tasked. Budget constraints, you're familiar with those. Lack of information, or maybe too much information. You can only swallow so much with the personnel on hand. And of course, I mentioned the problems of worst case analysis. What I'd like to do this evening is focus on a few with some historical examples that I think are among the more important problems we face. First one is lack of strategic vision. At the end of the Cold War, it seems to me, we really didn't have, we were caught by surprise, and we really did not understand where we wanted to go. What kind of post-Cold War world would we like to see emerge? What role should we play in encouraging that world to emerge? What challenges are we likely to confront as we try to move ahead, advancing our interests, simultaneously advancing the interests of our friends and allies around the world? What resources might we need to do that? How should we relate to the other actors in the international arena? Our allies, our friends, our potential friends, newly independent states in Eastern Europe, Russia, China, other countries. What roles might we conceive of them playing and helping us shape this new international environment that we were trying to create? And how could we encourage them rather than dissuade them by our own policies to act in what we would hope they would see is also in their interests? In short, we were confronting a new world with new levels of complexity. Even today, after 9/11, the focus became, well, not so much today now, but after 9/11, the focus became on a global war on terrorism. But terrorism isn't an enemy. Terrorism is a means. And all those same questions seem to have gone unanswered as we approach dealing with the problem of terrorism. So with this new world, with these new levels of complexity, what do? Immediately at the end of the Cold War, we cut the State Department's budget. We cut the intelligence community's budget. We cut the defense community's budget. We cut the Agency of International Development's budget. All of those instruments of national power that might lead us to gather the kind of information necessary to shape a new world that we might have in mind. The reason the book is titled as it is, Of Knowledge and Power, is simply because as an Air Force Academy graduate, I used to walk outside of the dining hall, Mitchell Hall, every day, and in front of the dining hall in Mitchell Hall is an eagle. And the inscription on the eagle is, man's flight through life is sustained by the power of his knowledge. And it's just not man's flight, it's nation's flight. And we need to invest and monitor the intelligence community so that we produce the absolute best intelligence to sustain this nation in the future. So the first problem we have is if you don't have good vision, you don't know what to task. You have the intelligence community going ad hoc over a whole bunch of things, but you never know exactly what you need to frame this new new environment. Second thing I think most important is, or more important, is the absence of critical thinking. This perhaps is the greatest challenge to management in the intelligence community, as well as management at senior levels of decision making. Analysts need to be trained, but also encouraged to think counterintuitively. They need to ask what information they should challenge, not what the information is. However, very frequently find in bureaucratic environments that bureaucratic pressures exist from senior policymakers all the way down to the analyst to confirm senior policy predispositions, not to think counterintuitively, not to ask what the information says, but what the information may not say, to examine every bit of information from every possible perspective, not every reasonable perspective. If I examine it from every reasonable perspective, sometimes it's pretty easy to confirm policy predispositions. If I examine it from every possible perspective, I raise questions that need to be answered by perhaps additional intelligence that might suggest something quite contrary to what we think happens to be the case. Some of the greatest failures of intelligence have been the result of reasonable reasoning. In 1941, Japan, it was reasoned, wouldn't start a war with the United States it couldn't hope to win. Why, that's reasonable. Why would they attack at Pearl Harbor? They can't win this war. In June 1944, the Allies would cross the channel at Pas-de-Calais. Everything pointed to it. And the Germans, that was reasonable thinking. The shortest way across that fictitious army on the other side, under General Patton's command. In 1961 in Cuba, Moscow wouldn't risk putting missiles in Cuba. That was reasonable. 1973, the Arab-Israeli War. Arabs would not attack Israel in a war they couldn't hope to win. All of these are examples of reasonable analysis. So perhaps the conclusion that we reached prior to going into Iraq in 2003 was the result of reasonable reasoning. I mean, after all, we knew Saddam had, you know, chemical weapons. He'd used them. We knew he had biological materials. We gave them to him. Third thing I'd like to point out is cognitive bias. A couple of examples. Pearl Harbor in 1941. A whole host of factors, of course, contributed to our being caught by surprise, but I would argue that cognitive bias, predisposition, so to speak, was very high on the list. Predisposition of the Army command at Pearl Harbor to view the Japanese threat as one that was primarily sabotage. So we lined up our aircraft in nice rows, protected them very carefully on our airfields. Predisposition that the chance of an air attack was negligible. That Pearl Harbor's harbor itself was too shallow for aerial torpedo attack. And, you know, if the United States didn't have the capability to do shallow torpedo attacks, then surely the Japanese didn't have that capability. And then there was racial prejudice and cultural arrogance, together with a limited knowledge and understanding of the Japanese. Many thought the Japanese lacked inventive powers. They could only imitate. Many were captive of the cognitive bias in believing that those little yellow men, as Churchill sometimes spoke of them, were certainly incapable of accomplishing such an attack on Pearl Harbor. Another example of cognitive bias, 1941, Operation Barbarossa. In August 1940, Germany redeployed its forces eastward toward the Soviet Union. On the eve of the attack, there were 123 German divisions facing Russia. There was an increase in sabotage, increase in aerial reconnaissance. German deserters were reporting of an impending attack on the Soviet Union. The Soviet military attaché in Berlin had received copies of the attack order that he had passed on. But Stalin, serving as his own analyst, absolutely refused to believe that Hitler, after signing the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, would attack Russia. 1942, I love this one, Singapore. Perhaps the single most important factor in the ugly defeat of the British in Singapore was cognitive bias, predisposed. Since the turn of the century, Japan had been a rising power in Asia. Japan had surprised the world with its defeat of Russia in the Russo-Japanese War, 1904, 1905. In the 1920s and 1930s, the world saw a rise of Japanese militarism. For continued development of Japan, they needed the resources of Asia: coal, tin, iron, rubber. They had successfully, very successfully, invaded China in 1937. In September 1940, they had aligned themselves with Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. In 1941, they were bluntly spying on British military installations and exercises. On December 4th, 1941, a drunk Japanese soldier in a bar talking to a Royal Air Force serviceman mentioned the fact that the Japanese had planned to attack simultaneously Singapore and Pearl Harbor. The information was passed on to British intelligence the next day. The British simply refused to believe that those tiny men from Asia could defeat a superior white force. Many believed Japanese had poor vision. They were incapable of fighting in the dark or operating sophisticated machinery. One naval expert wrote, quote, "Every observer concurs. The Japanese are daring but incompetent aviators. They are a race of defects in tubes of their inner ears, just as they are myopic. This gives them a defect in the sense of balance. Moreover, they could not fire rifles because they can't close one eye at a time." Air Chief Marshal Robert Brooke Popham, who happened to be the Commander-in-Chief of British forces in the Far East at that time, perhaps best summed up the British attitude toward the Japanese on a visit to Hong Kong in 1940. Speaking of the Japanese guards that he saw across the border, he said, "I had a good look at them close up across the barbed wire. Of the various subhuman species dressed in dirty gray uniforms, if they represent the core of the Japanese army, I cannot believe that they would form an effective fighting force." Within a few days of their attack in Singapore following the attack on Pearl Harbor, they sank both of Britain's major warships, landed north of Singapore on the Malay Peninsula, came down through an incredible mishmash of jungle and trees, on bicycles, on whatever it took, and within a few days captured Singapore. One report says they captured Singapore still defended by about 130,000 British, Indians, and others, with a final arriving force of about 30,000 Japanese. This was a failing of predisposition in the First Order. 1973, how am I doing on time here? Okay. 1973, Arab-Israeli War. After the 1967 war, Minister Moshe Dayan was asked how he was able to defeat three armies in 6 days. He said, "Fight Arabs." In other words, the Arabs don't have a military culture and therefore can easily be defeated. Moreover, prior to the 73 war, the balance favored the balance of forces favored the Israelis. Major General Zahra, the chief of intelligence, was convinced that Syria and Egypt, in fact, were simply engaged in saber rattling. They would not attack. Major General Gon, the guy who was commander of the southern region of forces, received information 2 days before the attack that the possibility of war was at the lowest of lows. Abraham Rabinowitz wrote sometime afterward, "The intelligence chiefs believed that they knew a deeper truth that rendered irrelevant all the cries of alarm going on around them. Zahra and his chief aides were to demonstrate the ability of even brilliant men to adhere to the idée fixe in the face of mountains of contrary evidence, explaining away every piece of information that conflicted with their thesis, and embracing any wisp that seemed to confirm it." Sound familiar, ladies and gentlemen? Sound familiar, perhaps, of recent events? This was, and perhaps recent events were, cognitive bias at its best. To mention the 2003 period with regard to Iraq. Iraq surely had chems, as I mentioned. They had used them in the 80 to 88 war with Iran. We had reason to believe they still had some, if not quite a reasonable number. They had imported biological agents from the United States, so we knew they had biological agents. Even anthrax bacillus and other biological materials had been imported. We knew they had established a nuclear program. We, in the 1990-91 timeframe, after the 91 war, we realized they had a significant nuclear program. We were having reports of biological activity, biological labs, that they were supposedly seeking nuclear materials in the form of yellow cake from Niger, or Niger as we call it. They were seeking, they had purchased aluminum tubes that some elements within the intelligence community thought could be used in centrifuges. But the United Nations inspectors couldn't find a thing. But we discounted that completely. Hans Blick, in his book, writes, "Once the United States deployed forces to the region, Saddam Hussein became incredibly willing to open up facilities." Oh, they might be a 10 or 15 minute delay, but he'd open up facilities to us, but we couldn't find a thing with the best intelligence that the United States was able to give him. We had people on those teams who were very knowledgeable, but we weren't going to listen. It didn't fit our predispositions. I'm going to jump over access and sharing because I'm afraid we're running out of time here, but let me talk a little bit about politicalization. During almost any phase of the intelligence processes, we can be troubled by the problem of politicalization. From the very asking of the question, I can slant the question so that I get the information that serves my needs. But we also have it within the intelligence community, let's face it. There's careerism. People know that the president wants a certain outcome. I'm running a particular part of the intelligence community. I feel the pressure to produce the kind of information that the president or senior decision makers want, so I go to my analysts and I ask them to analyze what needs to be analyzed. I ask the question in a certain way so that I get the kind of answers that might advance the argument that's trying to be made. It's done for reasons of promotion, maybe favorable ratings from your superior, feeling a part of the team. I must say, I've dealt with a number of analysts over the years in the intelligence community. My sensing is they really fight this tooth and nail. They really do try to prepare information that is balanced in its approach. I'm not totally convinced from my experience within the military that that's true of the Defense Intelligence Agency. It may be. But my sensing is that there is a lot of pressure, and their focus is a little bit different. There is a lot of worst-case planning, and they tend, in many respects, to look at that the information and come up with worst-case planning. That may be, since I've not served with the Defense Intelligence Agency, may be unfair. Let me just point out a couple of historical examples of politicalization, because it's not just Republicans, it's not just Democrats, it's across the board. 1965, the Dominican Republic, a little bit of background on that. In 61, January 61, Trujillo was assassinated, and it followed a long period of political turmoil. In February of 63, a fellow by the name of Juan Bosch became president. And many people were concerned that he was allowing the communists too much room. 7 months later, he was overthrown by a military coup. In April of 1965, a group of army officers rebelled in an attempt to reinstall Juan Bosch in the presidency, and we had turmoil and battle in the streets in Santo Domingo. And Tap Bennett, our ambassador then, recommended that we send in the Marines. Johnson, concerned about the growth of communism involved in Vietnam, we didn't want any more problems, particularly in our hemisphere, he sends in the Marines, supposedly to protect American interests and the interests of others. He didn't consult the CIA, but he thought that the Cubans were involved. And he demanded of the CIA to provide evidence of Castro's involvement in the unrest, turmoil, and attempted coup. Didn't ask them. He demanded. Johnson also claimed publicly that there were headless bodies laying in the streets of Santo Domingo. And he asked Tap Bennett to find some headless bodies to support his view. 1969, Soviet Union develops a ballistic missile called an SS-9, and Johnson approved a Sentinel missile system to defend our cities. A lot of people thought, we don't want a system that defends our cities. It's going to wind up drawing additional Soviet attacking warheads to our cities. It was an issue during the elections. When Nixon comes to office, he orders a change to a safeguard system that is going to be designed to protect our missiles so that we'll have the capacity to retaliate against any Soviet attack. Our own ICBMs would be protected. But many people, particularly in the scientific community, did not think the safeguard system would work. It was, they argued that the radars were vulnerable, that the command and control system was vulnerable, that the system itself was not really able to deal not only with the missile, but potential decoys, that it could be easily overwhelmed by multiple missile attacks. But Nixon wanted this safeguard system to get through the legislature. So then Melvin Laird, Secretary of Defense, drops the bombshell in order to overcome the opposition to the SS-9, or to the safeguard system. He says, the Soviet Union is seeking a first strike capability with a multiple independently targetable reentry vehicle. That is a missile that actually contains many warheads that can be spun off within a footprint to hit different targets. Up until then, all that was available were multiple reentry vehicles. That is, we put three vehicles, or the Soviets would put three vehicles on their missile, and these would hit in a pattern around a single target to increase the prospect of destruction. But now multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles meant they could hit different missiles and cross target, which was a significant improvement in their capabilities. Therefore, we definitely needed safeguard to defend. The only problem with this is that the intelligence community had already clearly concluded that the SS-9 didn't have MIRV capability, multiple independently targetable reentry vehicle capability. Already concluded before Laird goes to testify before Congress. Now, he had other sources of intelligence that were helping him confirm what he thought he needed, including the Defense Intelligence Agency. Let me finish here by talking a little bit about the 2003 Iraqi war. President Bush, October 22nd, 2002. Iraq, he says, possesses and produces chemical and biological weapons. We know Iraq is engaged in high-level contact with al-Qaeda. Evidence indicates Iraq is reconstructing its nuclear program. Given that evidence, we cannot wait for final proof that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud. Cheney, August 7th, 2002. We know Saddam Hussein continues to pursue nuclear weapons. August 26th, in front of the VFW convention. Iraq regime is busy enhancing capabilities in chemical and biological warfare. He engaged in this consistent drumbeat. There is no doubt that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. We know he has a long-standing relationship with various terrorist groups, including al-Qaeda. Rice. We know Saddam Hussein is actively pursuing nuclear weapons. We know he has stored biological weapons. There is certainly evidence that Saddam Hussein is in cohorts with terrorists. The reality? None of that was true. So how did it happen? Certainly, the intelligence community bears a measure of blame, although I would argue that the congressional reports on this went far further than they should have. The executive summary clearly glossed over many of the important disagreements that existed within the intelligence community. You also have to remember that it is the director at that time, now director of national intelligence, at that time director of central intelligence, that ultimately decides what goes into the summary of the national intelligence estimate. The president was, in fact, predisposed to believe the worst. He believed Saddam Hussein, in my view, needed to be removed. In his first NSC meeting in 2001, as is well depicted by former Secretary of Treasury, one of the first issues is Iraq, out of the blue. After 9/11, Rumsfeld raised the question of, was Iraq involved in this? On July 2nd, Richard Dearlove, head of the British MI, Military Intelligence 16, informed the British Prime Minister that Bush wants to topple Saddam Hussein and warned that in Washington, D.C., intelligence is being fixed around policy. In the August press conference, Bush said ousting Saddam Hussein was one of his top priorities. In January of 2003, in his State of the Union message, he said Saddam Hussein for the past 12 years has been pursuing weapons of mass destruction. But the reality was, the intelligence community had long noted Iraq had not been working with al-Qaeda. The intelligence community knew the case on biological and chemical weapons was on thin ice. In 1995, General Kamal, one of Saddam Hussein's son-in-laws, reported that he had destroyed all the chems and bios. The case on the nuclear rearmament of Iraq was also on thin ice. The aluminum tubes, supposedly to be used in centrifuges, were judged by that organization in the United States that has the most knowledge of this, the Department of Energy, as not likely being capable to be used as centrifuges and more likely to be casings for artillery shells, which they turned out to be. The yellow cake had already been debunked by Joe Wilson, confirmed by our ambassador in Niger, confirmed by the deputy commander of European Command, who happened to be down there in Niger at the same time, since he had responsibility for Africa. Bush had had regular updates from the UN inspectors, but they didn't fit the predispositions, in my view, of the leadership in the United States. So predispositions of national leaders is, I think, one of the most important problems that we confront. There is clear evidence, in my view, in the last case and in all the others, that policy trumped intelligence, and intelligence was cherry-picked to provide information necessary to support policy. So let me stop with that, and let me open it up to any questions or comments you all would like to make.
Dr. Kennedy, I will move to the back of the room, and I invite those who have questions to line up with me at the back of the room, and I think there will be some questions.
Good.
We have learned a number of times the hard way that the financial markets don't always behave rationally, that occasionally there are interventions of people who cause the markets to act in irrational ways. We were stunned to learn this in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. Franklin Roosevelt responded, many would say, by installing a thief to catch a thief, as the head of the SEC when he put Joseph Kennedy in. Now we're stunned to learn again and again and again that perhaps our intelligence services or those who are interpreting their output, their product, don't always behave rationally. Mm-hmm. And that we are stunned and surprised to learn that repeatedly. Does this mean, and I don't mean this facetiously, does this mean that we need to get some sociopaths to run our intelligence agency to try to figure out what is the prescription? How are we to get intelligence that isn't cooked?
Well, there are two chapters in this book that I did not address this evening, and that is on executive branch oversight of the intelligence community and congressional oversight of the intelligence community. It is reasonable in the area of predispositions for people to act on those predispositions. The intelligence community does a pretty good job of trying to train its people not to do so. But you always have pressures from decision makers. It is the responsibility of Congress, primarily to make sure that we get accurate and effective intelligence. It is the responsibility of Congress to decide whether that information is sufficient to go to war. I would contend that Congress has abdicated its responsibility. I have done a few interviews on the Hill. I have read a great deal about what's gone on the Hill. A very senior person on the Senate Intelligence Committee had this to say, essentially. Well, we all knew Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. And I was polite and didn't respond. Had I been less polite, I would have said, that's exactly the problem, Senator, that you did not all know. You didn't know at all what Saddam Hussein had. Did you read, and I did ask this question, did you read the National Intelligence Estimate? Did you read the executive summary? At which point the senator turned to his aide and he said, we did look at that, didn't we? Dana Priest said, from her research, only six, not more than six people looked at the National Intelligence Estimate. Nobody went further into that. That's their business. We're going to war. We're going to kill people. Congress, in my view, and you're working on a war powers program here, Congress has abdicated its responsibility in terms of war powers. And in abdicating its responsibility in terms of war powers, it's turned the whole thing over to the executive branch. And then they go and investigate how well the executive branch has done its job, when they should have been, particularly the intelligence community, in my view, have been holding the intelligence community's feet to the fire. Give me all of the information. Brief me carefully. I have got to go in and vote as to whether I'm going to send Americans into harm's way. That's my obligation. That's my responsibility. So I think the first way you fix this problem, George, is you hold Congress's feet to the fire. I expect the executive department to try to do things that they think they'd like to do. That's why we have a separation of powers. That's why we have balances and checks, which are not apparently working.
It seems that one of our problems, perhaps, is effective communication between all the agencies that collect and analyze intelligence. And the more we have of these agencies, the more challenging this gets. How many agencies do we have in this business, and can we do with a dozen or so less and be more effective?
I don't think we can do with, I'm not one who likes to see a shrinking of the agencies because many of them have very different functions. I would like to see it better organized. I think right now the Director of National Intelligence does not 8 of the 15 agencies that we have are controlled by the Department of Defense, the Secretary of Defense. When the Secretary has priorities, guess what priorities get answered? For the most part, in the past, they have been those that the Secretary of Defense wants answered. We'll have to see how the record works with the new Director of National Intelligence, which has been given mildly more authority. But still, those branches, Congress did not give those eight agencies, Defense Intelligence Agency, all the services, to the National Reconnaissance Office. All of these major agencies still are under the Secretary of Defense. I don't think collapsing them will necessarily solve the problem. I think a little greater authority given to the Director of National Intelligence would solve some of those problems. Does that kind of get to what you're trying to? Okay. Yes, sir.
Professor Kennedy, thank you for your very illuminating discussion. I hope your book will get up here to Charlottesville so some of us can get it. My background has been in human source intelligence collection. And as I look at the two intelligence failures that you addressed and seem to be on most people's mind in the recent period, a failure to have a penetration of Saddam Hussein's entourage and a failure to have a penetration of Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda group, much mention has been made of the fact that we don't have human source intelligence in some of the areas where we need it most. I happen to believe that that is a very, very tough assignment, but one that the United States has to master. What's your take on this, and how would you go about improving our human source collection capability if we're right in saying that it's not up to snuff?
Well, I agree with you 100%. We have consistently denuded our intelligence capability in the area of human intelligence. Ever since the 60s, we've been drawing it down. And then with the advent of all these nice technologies that can sit up there in satellite form and look at all the missiles down in the holes, we've moved away from investments. As a matter of fact, when the Indians exploded their nuclear weapon, we had hardly anybody that in India that was looking at these issues. We had no human sources. And so I think it's very important that we rebuild that. It will not be an easy task. It takes a long time to train these people with language capabilities, with knowledge of the culture. It takes a long time to build sources in countries, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, so that those people will serve our interests. After all, we're asking people in many instances to provide us intelligence that if they're caught at it, they will be killed. They're to give their lives up. This is not easy, and it becomes less easy when the rest of the world no longer thinks that you're the kind of power they want to follow. Now, a lot of people have made comment about the decline in America's prestige abroad. And there have been a lot of responding comments to that. Oh, well, our prestige. My personal experience has been with people in our friendly countries in Western Europe, as well as countries like Russia, who at the end of the Cold War, many people held us in high regard. They have lost regard. And many Russians, for example, simply believe we're just another power out for our own interests. It's hard to recruit people under that situation. We have got to be firm in our values. This is something that goes back to Eisenhower. We have got to stand by our values as a nation. There's an interesting comment made as Ben Franklin's leaving the house that we constructed our Constitution in Philadelphia. He's supposedly confronted by a lady. He says, "So what did you do in there?" And he says, "Madam, we've constructed a republic if you can keep it. And the only way we can keep it is with our values. And the only way we can recruit people abroad willing to sacrifice their lives is that they believe that this nation is a nation of values. And those are values that they want to follow." So one of the ways is to adjust our foreign policy, not to be appeasing, but to be firm. Be firm in what we believe in and follow through as best we can. We can't always, follow through as best we can with that. And in so doing, it will help us rebuild the human intelligence part of our national security apparatus. Thank you.
Professor Kennedy, thank you for your excellent talk. I would like to ask, though, a process question, if I might. Even with all the changes in the U.S. intelligence after 9/11, we still are highly structured, formally tasked, and asked to find the answer. This goes on while the rest of the world's intelligence groups are networked and work as team clusters on asymmetric solutions to rapidly changing social and cultural processes. Now, can you talk a little bit about the fact that we're still in lockstep and not responding to what's going on in the world?
Well, you've asked a huge question that has many aspects and ramifications. Let me just address a couple of issues there. There is usually no one answer. Intelligence, depending on what sources you get, how good these sources are, there is seldom a single answer, and we should eschew efforts to provide a single answer. Decision makers like a single answer. Well, tell me whether they can do this or they can't do this. Tell me whether they're going to do this or they're not going to do this. The answer to a question like, is a country going to do something or not, is an unanswerable question. The leaders of that country might not know at the moment you ask the question what they would do. How could I, as an American, even in the Defense Department, respond to a question said with the president, if one nuclear weapon went off in New York City, and we knew it came from the Soviet Union, would I initiate a full counterstrike? How can I answer that question? Maybe the president couldn't answer the question until it happened. So the type of question you ask is very important in that, and understand that there's usually no single answer, and the importance of oversight, whether it's at the executive branch level or the congressional level, is to ferret out the if, ands, or buts, to ask the what if that information's wrong. What if we think, what is countering information? And then attempt, in the end, you have to come to some decision. It may not be the right decision, but at least you've gone through the process. My concern is we haven't gone through the process. Yes, sir.
I've been perplexed for a while over researching the period of January through March of 2003 as to why Colin Powell became a spokesman for the administration's point of view, when this is a man who had risen through the military, was totally familiar with the intelligence community, and according to him, had spent 3 days at CIA actually talking to analysts all the way down. Why did Colin Powell do it?
Of course, you're asking the wrong person that question. I was following events at that particular time, very carefully following them. As a matter of fact, I had a class on international relations that we were addressing those questions. Indeed, one day I asked all the people in the class, does Saddam Hussein have weapons of mass destruction? Actually, I asked the question, should we go to war against Saddam Hussein? And students raised their hand. One student said, yes, he has weapons of mass destruction. Okay, no, we shouldn't go because UN hasn't found any of these. We ought to do all those different aspects. Finally, at the end of the period, I turned to the student who had first said we need to go to war against Saddam Hussein because he had weapons of mass destruction. I said, I know you took the pen from the student next to you in the previous class. It's a very expensive pen, and I want you to return it to him or I'm going to flunk you. He says, well, I didn't take the pen. I says, no. I know you took the pen, and you have to return it or I'm going to flunk you. And all of a sudden, the light went on with the rest of the students who started to laugh. Well, we know he has weapons of mass destruction, but we can't find them, you know. Why he came to that conclusion, I don't know. We can all speculate on a variety of reasons. One, perhaps some of the information that was provided to him by people in the intelligence community was such that they knew he wanted that information. They were, acceding to policy requirements. They were bringing, I don't know those answers. Maybe it was because he's a loyal guy, military officer, who was there to serve his president, and he decided to stand behind his president. I don't know the answer to that. He's a guy you have to ask.
Dr. Kennedy, as a fellow Atlantean, thank you for your speech this evening. You gave a perspective of periods when there was really not advanced technology as far as information. The 2003, certainly we have sophisticated information. I'm just curious on your opinion on obviously, there's the need for more human intelligence, but are we using the resources that we have? I mean, I would imagine we have the most sophisticated computer modeling systems in the world with regard to intelligence gathering. And, are we relying too much on that? Are we not using them properly, or do we not have them?
I'm reluctant to answer that question because I'm not in the middle of the intelligence community, and I can't make judgments. So I wouldn't want to mislead you to think that I knew more than I do about that. I could only hope that we are doing a better job now of integrating our human intelligence efforts with and redirecting some of our collection methods and targeting methods to deal with contemporary problems. But I wouldn't want to venture into that area. That's not an area I claim any strong expertise in. But I thank you for that question.
To some of us, the intelligence agency community is a black box, big, mysterious, and expensive. We are steadily told that it scores successes in thwarting various plans against us. At the same time, we're told that no details can be divulged. Do you have any stories to tell us about this? And do you believe further that there should be some kind of Freedom of Information Act sooner rather than later about what is actually happening inside these agencies?
Well, having dealt with highly classified information throughout much of my career, I'm not certain that many aspects of what goes on need to be divulged to the average citizen. I think it really is for committees in Congress to exercise their prerogative in making sure that the right information is available to them, that the intelligence community is doing its job, and then for the American people to hold them responsible. I will tell you, after the Iraq War, I'm usually not too volatile. I'm shouting a lot, so that may sound like I'm volatile. But after the Iraq War, I felt like I should vote every single one of those congressmen who voted in favor of the resolution out of office. They didn't do their job. Now, I understand that Congress is busy. I understand that people outside of the intelligence community run over and find out how they should vote from people who supposedly know. I understand that happens all the time. But certainly members of the Senate Select Committee, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence should have done their job. They didn't, in my view. A few of them did, very few of them.
Thank you, Professor Kennedy, for this lecture. I've appreciated the opportunity to ask a couple questions that have been sort of swirling around in my brain for the last year, since 2003. They're rather specific. I was about as low on the totem pole on information as you can get, radio, TV, and newspapers. But as I remember, several days before the invasion, there was a large convoy reported headed for the Syrian border, reportedly with perhaps a lot of cash, certain high levels of individuals from Baghdad, and perhaps WMDs, chemical to be specific. And then several years later, at the border between Jordan and Syria, was a large cache and several trucks of chemical weapons headed for Amman, Jordan, specifically designed to eviscerate the intelligence and also perhaps governmental functions is there. I was just wondering if there was any connection there specifically that you had ever pieced together or heard of. And also the second part, I understand it. There was a several hundred nuclear scientists under the auspices of Baghdad and Saddam Hussein who were in fact working in Libya, not Iraq. That was shut down several years later.
Well, there's a whole host of aspects to the question you asked. First of all, I heard the same stuff constantly in unclassified form from Neil Bortz and Rush Limbaugh and others. I have not seen the intelligence on that. Whatever it happens to be may well have been classified. All I can say is that the inspectors who went through everything that we could give them didn't find anything. It's a very interesting question. Ask Hans Blix when he visits Chirac. He says to Chirac, he said, "I can't find a thing, no matter what intelligence I get." Yet all of the Western intelligence agencies are saying that Saddam has chemicals and biological weapons, has a nuclear weapon program. Why is that the case? Chirac says, because we all talk to each other. So you have a lot of that kind of comment. How much, I have not seen any intelligence, because I'm not in that business, that said those trucks going there had chems, bios, and nukes. I would not be at all surprised that Saddam may have had some people outside of country working on projects. That wouldn't surprise me a bit. Would that result in a mushroom cloud tomorrow? Was this an imminent danger that required us to throw troops into the region? Now that we're getting all sorts of openings through the inspections of the UN, why did we discount them? Why did Cheney make them look like they were serving Saddam instead of perhaps finding out what are the weaknesses? Where are the problems? What more do we need to do? No, we had to leap to war. That's what I object to. Maybe some of those weapons, maybe there were some weapons, I don't know. But I have not seen any evidence. I haven't asked anybody in the intelligence community, because if they had, they probably would, one way or the other, the methods might be revealed, so they can't reveal to me one way or the other, because it might compromise the methods they're using. But I have my suspicions that that's all bull. That's just suspicion, though, and I may be wrong. I do know, and we do know now, from the facts, that the United States was not posed with an imminent threat from Iraq. Even if he had some chems, he had some bios, and he had some kind of nuclear program, he had no means to deliver it against the United States. Could they have been weaponized, perhaps to use against Israel? Yeah, possibly. But in terms of us waking up to a mushroom cloud, which is what got the Americans animated, oh, well, we're going to wake up to a mushroom cloud, let's do something. That was policy trumping intelligence. That was politicalization of intelligence. That was cherry-picking information and not taking what was really available and using it to an effective way to ensure America's national security. The consequences, we own Iraq. The consequences are that we have lost a lot, in my view, lost a lot of authority in the international community. And we didn't have to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.